this vicious terrorist attack. Just a reminder that we must always be vigilant against the enemies of freedom.
The evidence is all around us that there is a global Islamist political movement. It does rule countries, it does destabilize countries. It is, as the Arab Spring showed us, it is powerful, it's organized, and it's waiting in the wings to take over even more countries than it's already ruling.
I am holding in my hand the Muslim Brotherhood plan for the destruction of the United States.
It's time for the world to wake up. In just the past 4 months, we have seen a sharp spike in the number of radical Islamic terror attacks around the world.
It seems governments all throughout the European continent have been ill-prepared to deal with the growing threat of radical Islamic terrorism.
Tell me, what is the ideology of a radical extremist? I'll tell you what the ideology of a radical Islamist is. It's the Quran, it's Sharia, and it's the Hadith.
We will reinforce old alliances and form new ones and unite the civilized world against radical Islamic terrorism, which we will eradicate completely from the face of the earth.
Since September 11th and the launch of the global war on terror, we have been told that we live under threat of political Islam. This argument has taken many forms. Some say outright that Islam is a violent and irrational religion that inherently leads towards terrorist violence. Others argue that the entire Middle Eastern region hasn't fully caught up with the progressive West, which is why it requires interventions from powers like the United States. The earliest stages of the war on terror, the invasion of first Afghanistan and then Iraq, were justified along these lines: that the people of these countries had not been able themselves to bring democracy to their country, and therefore it was the responsibility of the United States to build a democratic government on the basis of a military invasion. But over the last decade and a half, we have watched as the interventions in the name of fighting terrorism have somehow only seemed to contribute to the conditions for increased terror. After more than a decade of attempting to exterminate Al-Qaeda, the United States and its allies was shocked by the emergence of the Islamic State in 2013. So what are the connections between political Islam and its extremist variants to the long-standing tradition of Western intervention in the Middle East? And moreover, what are the reasons for this intervention? Why has the Middle East for so long been a prime military and political objective for the major powers of the world? And what can ordinary people do, both in the Middle East and in the United States, as well as elsewhere, to actually challenge this horrific state of affairs?
You're listening to Propaganda, episode 1.3, ISIS, Imperialism, and the Roots of Islamophobia, a discussion with Y.L. El-Assadi. Part 1.
Wael El-Assadi is a Syrian-Palestinian who grew up in the United States. He is a longtime activist for Palestinian rights and has published and spoken on the question of the Syrian Revolution. Wael is a member of the International Socialist Organization and a contributor for Socialist Worker newspaper.
To be able to justify the occupation, colonization, brutalization of another group of people, you had to develop an ideology that dehumanized those people and justified it. And this is kind of the underpinning of the war on terror, and the justification for the U.S. as well as European powers to be able to intervene in the Middle East for their own interests. Islamophobia isn't just kind of some set of bad ideas that exist in people's head and some prejudices, but they are really fanned and developed as a part of an imperial project. Imperialism is a world system by which various nation states who represent conglomerations of capital compete over domination of the rest of the world, markets, labor resources, and for geopolitical combination. The working class is an international class that has historically been divided along national lines, ethnic lines, religious lines, and the ruling classes use that to maintain these divisions and pit us against each other. But ultimately, what we have to do, you know, is oppose our ruling classes, their racism towards other nations, and actually unite workers across the world to be able to challenge capitalism.
Political Islam is not a long-standing historical tradition within the Middle East. Instead, it is a response to modern interventions by the West, first France and Britain, and later the United States, in the region. This began before any of the countries that we now recognize as Middle Eastern countries were formed. Most of the region was under the control of the Ottoman Empire, and this was the main political unit that France and Britain attempted to destabilize leading up to World War I. Well, World War I itself proved the final demise of the Ottoman Empire, which in the ensuing breakup was partitioned by the European powers according to their own economic and political interests. This is the heritage of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. After World War II, the system of divisions built by France and Britain were taken on by the United States. Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Israel proved to be three of the foundations for American power. That is, at least up until the Iranian Revolution of 1979, which brought in a regime hostile to U.S. interests in the region and likely to work with Russia and other competitors to the U.S. system. In the wake of the Iranian Revolution, the United States turned to Iraqi strongman Saddam Hussein, who carried out 8 years of warfare against the regime. This bloodied both sides, ending in a stalemate, which helped to shore up the fundamentalist Shiite regime in Iran and strengthen Saddam's regime in Iraq. So the United States, in playing off the two sides against one another, supported dictatorships and strengthened sectarian conflict. After supporting Saddam Hussein against Iran, the United States would turn its full military might against the dictatorship after his invasion of Kuwait in 1990. Bush Sr. used the Gulf War to break the back of the Iraqi military and to justify putting American forces in the region, especially in Saudi Arabia, to secure against further actions by so-called rogue states. After the Gulf War, the United States imposed a regime of economic sanctions, which has directly contributed to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children, and also stalled any kind of economic redevelopment in the wake of the war. And this is all just setting the stage for the invasion of 2003. The campaign of shock and awe devastated Iraqi infrastructure, created millions of refugees, and has left at least a million dead in the country. The United States moved quickly to secure oil wells and the oil ministry and begin reforming the state-controlled economy into something that fit into the global neoliberal order. However, it became quickly apparent to the majority of Iraqis that their water, their electricity, and their basic needs were not going to be secured by the American occupation. First protests and then armed resistance emerged between the various factions within Iraqi society.
ISIS's rise really comes out of the Iraq War. And obviously it has a longer connection with Al-Qaeda's history, but ISIS specifically begins to emerge in 2004 with Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who's a Jordanian who essentially helps found the what was at that time Al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2004. And its rise is really ultimately a result of the invasion and occupation by American forces. It's able to rise as a result of really three things. When the American forces invade and the provisional government is set up, they essentially decide to disband the Iraqi army, outlaw the Ba'ath Party, and this does a couple of things. One is it essentially makes unemployed a whole section of the population, and both Sunni and Shia in the country. And then with the Ba'ath Party in particular, again, forces a whole bunch of civil servants and the main section of the bureaucracy out of the Ba'ath Party and out of jobs. And on the other hand, the U.S. occupation forces really end up using sectarianism as a method for combating what was emerging as a national insurgency against the U.S. occupation. There was a real threat of the Sunni insurgency connecting with the Shia insurgency, specifically with Muqtada al-Sadr's movement, and this was going to be essentially a really big disaster for the U.S. in terms of being able to maintain their occupation. So they essentially played up sectarianism and used, the old divide and conquer strategy to be able to divide what was emerging as a national anti-occupation movement. And they instilled, they basically put forward a political system in Iraq that was based on sectarianism, that was based on representation proportional to the different sects in the country. So in a way, they helped institutionalize the sectarian system. And then they also ended up, on the one hand, allying with what emerged as what was the majority in the country, the elite of the Shia population, who essentially were able to take power in the aftermath of the fall of Saddam Hussein. And the U.S. forces allied with them as a way for them to stabilize the country, and participated essentially in a campaign of attacking the Sunni insurgency, not only forces that were related to Al-Qaeda, but the Sunni insurgency more widely. And what this did was essentially open up a space by which Al-Qaeda in Iraq was able to gain more and more support from wider layers of people on the basis that a new that the Sunni population had been disenfranchised from power. You had a whole bunch of people, as I said, who were now out of work, unemployed because of the disbanding of the army and the Ba'athist bureaucracy. And you had a new Shia state, which itself was sectarian and repressed much of the Sunni population. And Al-Qaeda in Iraq was able to essentially use this situation to build its base of support. And its strategy, Abu Musa al-Zarqawi really put forward a strategy that was a break from Al-Qaeda strategy more generally, which was he wanted to exasperate the sectarian divide that was emerging. So he developed a strategy of attacking Shia shrines, attacking Shia neighborhoods and populations as a way to essentially help spur a sectarian civil war in the country, polarize the country, and therefore pull the Sunni population behind Al-Qaeda in Iraq's strategy. And this was, you know, so this was different from what Ayman al-Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden's strategy had been laid out. And there was a lot of debates about this. They, of course, themselves took a sectarian position in terms of Shia doctrine and saw them as non-Muslims. But their strategic orientation was not to attack Shia civilians or shrines, but rather to focus on the U.S. occupation forces. In a letter, they said, and we can deal with the Shia later. Essentially, Zarqawi's strategy was different in that they specifically wanted to create a sectarian civil war. They saw that this dynamic was emerging and that they could manipulate the essentially feelings of disenfranchisement by the large by the Sunni population inside of Iraq and use that as a way to gain support. The U.S. occupation, the way in which it essentially destroyed the Iraqi state institutions, and the sense by the Sunni population of disenfranchisement with the rise of what was a Shia state that itself had sectarian intentions, essentially created the breeding grounds for the rise of Al-Qaeda. And generally, the huge amount of really what was a violent situation, you know, in a miserable situation for a lot of people, the kind of devastation that was wrought on Iraq helped create that atmosphere as well. For example, if you look at where most of ISIS main leading cadre and leading members ended up meeting was in the various prisons of the American occupation forces. So the U.S. occupation forces would round up every, you know, anybody who opposed the U.S. occupations, throw them in these prisons, and in a way radicalize people and then open up a space by which radical extremists could essentially recruit on that basis, as well as organize themselves, meet each other, and create the networks that would form ISIS.
After World War II, the colonial system that had maintained a favorable status quo to the European capitalist powers was no longer viable. And in the face of this system, Arab nationalist movements developed that mobilized millions of people and ended up culminating in the victories of Nasserism in Egypt and Ba'athism in Syria and Iraq. These movements posed a threat to the hegemony of Western capitalist power in the Middle East. They nationalized industries previously owned by European or American firms and developed those industries with an eye towards becoming independent of the industrial capacities of the major developed powers. This was seen as a threat economically to Western capitalism, but Arab nationalism also posed a political threat. By breaking away from the Western powers, it proposed a third way between the US-led liberal capitalist order on the one hand and the Soviet bloc on the other hand, the so-called socialist or communist countries. Between these two poles of the Cold War, Arab nationalism attempted to negotiate its own path. This was seen as a major threat to American interests in the region. And the U.S. responded not only by undermining the Arab nationalist movements, which, compared to the political regimes before them, were progressive and democratic despite their own limitations. the United States would also support political Islam as a conservative counterbalance to Arab nationalism. While the actual governments of Arab nationalism utilized a top-down form of state capitalism, in which a small bureaucratic elite controlled industry, production, and major investment decisions, at the same time, the struggles of Arab nationalism had mobilized working class Arabs and other groups to resist not only Western powers, but to see the actual capitalist system itself as a threat to the well-being of everyday people. And so in addition to an Arab nationalist movement that was nationalizing key industries and challenging American foreign policy, there was a grassroots working class left movement that was looking to challenge the overall system itself and to link up with other struggles against capitalism around the globe. So the US really had two major tasks it had to carry out. It had to take back what had been lost in terms of its power as a result of the growth of Arab nationalism and the successes, particularly of Nasserism. It had to regain that economic and political leverage that it had lost. In addition to this, the United States also had to break the developing left-wing movements that could potentially pose even a greater threat to U.S. interests in the region than the Nasserist and Ba'athist forms of Arab nationalism. In order to destabilize Arab nationalism and undermine viable left-wing movements, the United States turned to political Islam as a conservative force in the region. By developing political Islam as a bulwark against left-wing politics, the United States not only undermined the democratic projects of millions of Arabs, it also set the stage for the brutal sectarian violence that plagues the region today.
It's worth pointing out that in terms of this idea that has sectarianism always existed in the Middle East, that it's, you know, that's some primordial, you know, natural thing that is just inherent to Muslim people or to the people of the region. That's just simply not true. Really, sectarianism emerges with the rise of capitalism in the Middle East, and it emerges as a result of very complex, you know, economic dynamics that happen. But essentially, it emerges as a result of two primary things, which really those dynamics continue to this day. One, it emerges as a result of imperial powers who attempt to utilize sectarianism, their relationship with various minorities in the region, as leverage to gain an economic, political foothold inside of the region. And you see that as early as the relationship between the British and the French and the Ottoman Empire, right? They were able to essentially get economic concessions and political concessions into the empire on the basis that they're protecting Christian minorities in the empire. So imperialism plays a role in creating these sectarian dynamics. And on the other hand, the regional ruling classes are a central element of it. That is to say, for a minority, you know, of the ruling class, you know, of the capitalist class, to be able to maintain the majority of wealth, political power, and so on, while the vast majority of people suffered in the region, they needed ways to be able to maintain the divisions inside of their population and maintain their wealth. So they helped push a lot of these divisions and use them as a way to maintain their dominance. So there's nothing natural, you know, about it, but it rather arises with a particular historical period, the rise of capitalism, and it's pushed, exasperated, and utilized by particular social actors for their own interests in the region. You know, my sense is I don't think the United States wanted to push sectarianism just to do that. I think they would have preferred other options had they been able to essentially occupy the country, push through the neoliberal reforms that they wanted to, put those in power, you know, that would carry out their wishes. They would have been happy to do that without resorting to sectarianism, you know, because there is a destabilizing effect that it has on the country. With that said, their overriding goal was essentially to maintain dominance over Iraq, right? They invaded the country on the basis that that after the fall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. emerged as the sole superpower, but U.S. strategic planners understood that that would not last forever, that there were rising powers in China that in some 50 years' time would economically overcome the United States if left unchecked. And they felt like they had a particular space of time by which they could essentially lock in their dominance across the globe. And the invasion of Iraq was a central element of that, in the sense that if they could now replace what was a sometimes supportive dictator, sometimes not supportive dictator in the form of Saddam Hussein, someone who essentially they weren't able to fully control, but if they were able to go in and overturn the political system, they would essentially have full control of the most geostrategic resource in the region, oil, right? And that would, for what was their imperial competitor, specifically in China, who was going to need oil to be able to, for its massive industrial expansion, they would essentially have the levers over that most strategic commodity. So I just say all that just to kind of point out how absolutely central Iraq was in their mind as a geopolitical element of that puzzle by which they hoped to maintain their globally dominant position. So they were willing to go to any lengths to carry that out. So when they invade, and rather than people cheering them and welcoming them with open arms as they expected, they instead are met with an insurgency, and one that's increasingly taking a national character. They end up resorting to whatever means necessary to be able to carry out their goals, including sectarianism. So certainly sectarian tensions existed before the invasion by the U.S. in 2003. So you had, for example, in the aftermath of the first U.S. Attack on Iraq in 1991, there was a Shia uprising that occurred, which was viciously repressed by Saddam Hussein's regime. You know, the Iraq-Iran war that had happened throughout the 80s had further exasperated sectarian tensions in Iraq. And generally, there was a feeling by the Shia, who were the majority of the population, that they were a repressed and underrepresented minority in the government. Of course, Saddam Hussein's regime always covered itself in Arab nationalism rather than Islamist terms. But Saddam was a Sunni. And of course, the core leadership were drawn from his family and his closest relations in his city. And therefore, there was an element of, a sectarian dynamic that already existed. Now, this has historically been overcome multiple times. So, for instance, you had a communist party in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, which gained massive support among the Iraqi population and crossed both amongst Sunnis and Shia. In fact, most of its many of its leadership were composed of Sunni, as well as across ethnic lines. So you had support among the Kurdish population as well. That is to say, the class composition and the political content of politics at that point determined politics and were able to overcome those sectarian divides. But nonetheless, although those tensions and that sense of marginalization by the Shia community certainly existed, there was nowhere near the level of the sectarianism that kind of really, it's not until the Iraq War that it emerges really as a primary identification. There were intermarriages between Shia and Sunni. The question of whether you're Shia and Sunni was not something that people thought about, talked about every single day. It wasn't a primary form of identification. And that really doesn't emerge until the aftermath of the U.S. invasion and the dynamics that I explained earlier that helped lead to sectarianism coming to be a dominant dynamic. The roots of ISIS, its lineage obviously goes back to Al-Qaeda, and this predates the 2003 Iraq War. And what you really had was, by the end of the 1960s, the Arab nationalist movements, which had taken power in Egypt under Gamal Abdel Nasser, the Ba'athists in Syria and Iraq, were essentially stalling. Their state-led form of capitalism was failing. It was causing massive amounts of inequality, and the economic growth that they had been able to spur was coming to an end. And so the failure of Arab nationalism on the one hand, and on the other hand, the failure of the communist parties to cohere an independent movement of the working class, and instead carrying out the Popular Front strategy of attaching themselves and often liquidating themselves into these Arab nationalist formations, left the door open for Islamic fundamentalist movements to emerge as the dominant opposition by the 1970s as the neoliberal period opened up. And so these states carried out neoliberal and austerity politics, where they pushed back subsidies, attacked the social safety net, lowered wages for state workers, and so on. And you begin to see resistance across the Middle East against these policies. But at this point, like I said, the left alternative, the communist parties, had fully attached themselves to the regime. And so this opened up a space for various Islamist movements to really step in. And a couple of things happen that really allow the emergence of Al-Qaeda and kind of this extremist wing of the Islamic fundamentalist movement to emerge. One is, there's a huge amount of repression against the mainstream currents of political Islam. That is the Muslim Brotherhood that's carried out by the regimes under Nasser and later under Anwar al-Sadat and Hosni Mubarak. And a section of that, the Muslim Brotherhood, essentially come to the conclusion that the gradualist approach of the Muslim Brotherhood is no longer working, that you have to overthrow these regimes to be able to create the Islamic society that they hope to create. So that's one element of it. Another element of it is, and it's important to note that the kind of extremist breakoffs in the Muslim Brotherhood are largely fragmented, don't carry a lot of weight at this point. But two things change that. One is that the United States, because of the rise of Arab nationalist movements and radical movements across the Middle East and its competition with the Soviet Union, strategically determines that it wants to support Islamist movements as a counterweight to the rise of Arab nationalism, which threatened its dominance and geopolitical hold on the region. And so the U.S., through its surrogate and its ally, Saudi Arabia, supports Saudi Arabia's efforts to essentially expand, finance these different Islamist movements. And this culminates ultimately in what was the support by the CIA, the Saudi Arabian state, which ultimately finances what were known as the Arab Mujahideen in Afghanistan, in which the Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan in support of the communist-led government against the insurgency that existed there. And the U.S. and Saudi Arabia essentially finance and train the Arab Mujahideen as a counterforce to the Soviets inside of Afghanistan. And this is really a watershed moment in the sense that it, for the first time, brings together into one location all the different extremist breakoffs that I had mentioned earlier from the Muslim Brotherhood and from these different Islamist currents, and brings them into one location. And essentially through a 10-year-long war, they are able to be trained into a much more coherent force and hardened as a fighting force against the Soviet Union and its allies and the Afghan government. And that really is the crystallization of that current. So Al-Qaeda comes out of that. Obviously, Osama bin Laden is one of the main leaders in this moment. Al-Zarqawi, who goes on to found Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which later become ISIS, actually also ends up in Afghanistan fighting the Mujahideen again and meeting Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri. So this was really a gathering place and the point at which they all crystallized. And then later, as the Soviets retreat from Afghanistan and as the U.S. attacks Iraq in the 1990s and becomes the predominant power, stations forces in Saudi Arabia, they turn from a focus on the Soviet Union to attacking the United States, as well as any Arab states that are allied with the U.S. So it's just important to understand that U.S. imperialism was a central element of backing and supporting the establishment of these various Islamic fundamentalist movements in the region. So far from seeing them as anti-imperialist forces in any genuine way that can cohere a national resistance, I think they've been tied in many ways to imperialism from the beginning, despite their rhetoric. And they actually fail at being able to cohere any kind of national anti-imperialist resistance because of their sectarian nature. They often end up actually fragmenting, helping the fragmentation of the various nations in the Middle East.
The picture, as Wael lays out for us, shows that the imperialist competition between major powers such as the United States and the former USSR has massive repercussions in the regions where those conflicts are played out. So ISIS itself has its roots in Mujahideen training camps that the CIA and its allies in Saudi Arabia, as well as Pakistan, were supporting. This helps to clarify an important aspect of how modern imperialist relationships between competing powers plays itself out. We can look at major competitors over political and economic control, for example, the United States and Russia, who are competing over influence in the Middle East right now. Russia has supported Assad and is working with Iran and Hezbollah to shore up his regime, while the United States has sought to find elements of the opposition that will be compliant with its neoliberal policies, but outcomes on the ground are not predetermined by the intentions of these major parties. Things have not gone the way the United States has wanted in either Syria or Iraq. As a result of the sectarianization of the uprising in Iraq, the United States has inadvertently given more power and influence to Iran and its allies in the government. On the other hand, in Syria, while the United States originally looked to replace Assad with a more compliant leadership, U.S. policymakers are now willing to negotiate with Russia to keep Assad in power in order to stabilize the region against ISIS. But this isn't simply a matter of unintended consequences. It is important to remember that the United States, for all of its power, is not all-powerful, and that events in neither Syria nor Iraq play out exactly as they want. Local powers, such as Saudi Arabia and Iran, have massive influence in their regional spheres and are often able to maneuver far more effectively than major powers who are ultimately out of their element when they attempt to affect political events in the region.
So I think, you know, obviously the rise of sectarianism, as we mentioned, was related to the Iraq War and the way that the U.S. used the divide and conquer strategy and essentially, disintegrated the Iraqi state. But another element in the way in which sectarianism has been spread around the region is an emerging competition, an intensification of the competition between Iran and Saudi Arabia. In which you begin to see, you know, in which Iran emerges as another Islamic powerhouse in the Middle East with, again, vast oil reserves that is in competition with Saudi Arabia, which saw itself as the guardian of Islam and so on. And so the competition begins there, but it really begins after the 2003 war, in which the removal of Saddam Hussein, far from cementing the dominance of the U.S. and its allies in the region like Saudi Arabia, actually ends up upsetting the balance of power and becomes an opening for further expansion of Iranian influence into Iraq and across the region. And so Saudi Arabia's response to this was to step up its foreign policy to counteract Iranian influence, and that often included one of its main weapons, which is spreading its version of Salafi Islam across the region. Through the 70s, 80s, 90s, and the 2000s, it obviously spent billions of dollars in building mosques, schools, supporting different movements that specifically spread its version of Salafi Islam, which is very puritanical and has always had a very strong anti-Shia element to it from its founding, but which is now specifically being used as a way to essentially create antagonism to Iran, and as a way to cohere a Sunni resistance to Iranian influence in the region. So that's actually further exasperated the sectarianism. On the one hand, Saudi Arabia, who's fanning anti-Shia, anti-Iranian rhetoric and supporting factions of that sort in Syria and Iraq and across the region. And on the other hand, Iran, who is expanding its support, Iran doesn't overtly express this in anti-Sunni rhetoric the way that Saudi Arabia does. Rather, it attempts to cover its policy as anti-imperialism and as being opposed to Israel and opposed to U.S. imperialism. But in reality, it functions the same way in exasperating the sectarian tensions, insofar as they essentially support regimes like Bashar al-Assad, who is carrying out massive amounts of repression against the majority Sunni population for daring to rise up against him. in supporting the various Shia governments that emerged in Iraq, which were sectarian in nature, and in supporting and organizing the various militias inside Shia militias inside of Iraq, inside of Syria, which have carried out sectarian attacks on the Sunni population, similar to the way that Al-Qaeda and ISIS have carried out sectarian attacks on the Shia population. So these two powers in their geopolitical struggle for dominance of the Middle East are essentially weaponizing and using sectarianism as a way to attempt to essentially push their dominance on the region, and it's having effects on the ground. So, you know, if the genesis of ISIS was the result of the invasion and fragmentation, devastation of Iraq, then it really its expansion and its coming onto the international scene was a result of the counter-revolution in Syria. And in Syria, what you have, and obviously across the region in 2011, was a set of massive uprisings by which millions of people poured into the street in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Yemen, in Qatar, in Bahrain, and then in Syria, demanding essentially the removal of the old regimes and dictatorships which had governed these countries for decades at this point, and against the huge amount of economic misery that people felt across the region, and Syria was no different. So you had a massive, largely peaceful uprising that first demanded reforms of the Syrian regime. And then as soon as the regime began to respond to it in massive amounts of repression, began to demand the downfall of the regime. So the response of Assad to this to these mass protests was twofold. One, as I explained, was massive amounts of repression. So you see Assad attack this uprising with helicopter gunships, live ammunition, massive jailings and torturing of activists. And on the other hand, Assad takes the approach of divide and conquer of the opposition. What he realizes essentially is a mass democratic uprising, demanding a democratic Syria and so on, would be very, very difficult to defeat. And rather, he aimed to kind of attempt to move it in a sectarian direction and to divide the opposition. And he did that in multiple ways, right? So probably the most important thing he did was he released over 1,500 Islamic fundamentalists and extremists from prison, and released them with the specific purpose of attempting to essentially create a fifth column inside of the revolutionary movement. That is to say, the revolution as it began was portrayed by the Assad regime from the very beginning as a foreign conspiracy made up of Islamic jihadists who would essentially, if left unchecked, would take power, you know, murder all the minorities and turn Syria into a fundamentalist theocracy. That was the message that Assad pushed from the beginning. That obviously was not the reality. It was a mass democratic movement, an uprising. So he went about creating that reality by releasing the Islamic fundamentalists on the one hand. And it's important to note that he's actually had, you know, the Assad regime has long used Islamic fundamentalist and extremist movements like Al-Qaeda and various jihadists as a geopolitical tool in the region. So, you know, Al-Qaeda's movement through Iraq, for example, and the insurgency against the against the U.S. invasion was largely facilitated by the Assad regime, which provided support, transport across the border for a lot of these for al-Qaeda and a lot of these movements in Iraq. So the relationships existed, right? He releases them from prison. And then the other element is not only releasing them from prison, understanding that they would create the nuclei of essentially new Islamist extremist forces, but that he would, but he also targeted the democratic forces, right? And this is the kind of situation in which ISIS emerges inside of Syria. So for example, Raqqa would fall to ISIS as early as 2013, and the regime would actually maintain a tactical neutrality with them, would not attack ISIS in Raqqa, but rather focused all of his firepower on Aleppo, on Idlib, on the south, in which the Free Syrian Army and the Democratic Forces were present. And so he wanted to essentially grind down, attack, murder the democratic forces, make them a non-force, and allow the rise of these Islamist extremists so that he could say, this is the only alternative to me. And that was a message both to the international powers, that is to say, if you support the downfall of my regime, what you will have is al-Qaeda and ISIS. And it was also a message internally to minorities and secular Syrians, which is, if my regime falls, what you will have is ISIS or al-Qaeda, and minorities will be murdered and so on, and will live under a theocracy. So he went about creating that reality, and in many ways that worked. You know, he was able to gain the support of significant sections of the minority Alawi community and the Christian community on the basis of the fear of what would happen if his regime was to fall and al-Qaeda or ISIS were to come to power. The important thing to say about ISIS in terms of its emergence in Iraq is you end up with multiple players inside of Syria, various political Islamist currents that are there. Initially, the main al-Qaeda formation inside of Syria is the al-Nusra Front, which again was a joint project of Syrians who already had connections to al-Qaeda, a few of them, again, being the ones that had been released by Bashar al-Assad, and then support from the al-Qaeda in Iraq branch. And they actually, at the very beginning, there emerges a big divergence between the al-Qaeda in Iraq branch and the al-Nusra Front leadership that was based in Syria. Al-Qaeda in Iraq essentially announces ISIS for the first time, which is the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, right? Or ISIL of the Levant, right? So their strategy was to essentially, and they put it forward this way, they want to get rid of Sykes-Picot and the old lines between Iraq and Syria, and that the al-Qaeda branches both in Syria and Iraq were now under one leadership, that of the leadership in Iraq. And their strategy was essentially to create a new Islamic State, which they had called, that would get rid of these borders and create a new caliphate in that region. Sykes-Picot was essentially an agreement that the French and the British came to after World War I about how they were going to carve up the Arab territory of the crumbling Ottoman Empire. And it was essentially a whole bunch of very artificial boundaries, right? So the majority of the region, you know, from what is Syria to Iraq to Jordan to Palestine, were known as Bilad al-Sham. And it was a region that was much more economically integrated, with no boundaries, and so on, and culturally, very similar. And then the British and the French essentially carve out this map that created whole new states, but that didn't really align with the reality of you know, people's lives and what the economic and cultural reality was on the ground. And so that ends up becoming the basis of all these different states: Syria, Iraq, Jordan, Palestine. Obviously, you know, they supported the colonial settler state of Israel, and it has always been a they've always been understood to be artificial borders that various ideologies have tried to transcend. So you had pan-Arab nationalism, which wanted to unite the various Arab countries, and then pan-Islamism, which also wanted to unite the Arab countries and beyond into a wider Islamic state. And ISIS in particular is pushing a version of this for, and arguing for the dissolving the boundaries, at least, you know, between Iraq and Syria to create their caliphate. And this differed with both, the Syrian, leadership of al-Qaeda, as well as the international leadership in Zawahiri and Pakistan, who basically put out their line was no, they're two separate branches, and the al-Nusra Front is who is responsible for al-Qaeda's activities in Syria. And again, this was based on a difference of priorities. ISIS wanted to essentially establish a state between the two boundaries. They were willing to essentially push off the battle with Bashar al-Assad until a later period. In fact, not even fight him for some time, again, on the basis of how can we actually dominate territory, establish institutions, and so on. And al-Nusra Front's strategy was to set, first off, al-Nusra had much more indigenous following inside of Syria, meaning its membership were Syrians, while ISIS actually was mostly Iraqis as well as foreign fighters that came in. And so al-Nusra's strategy was always to essentially attempt a softer form of its rule, with the goal of overthrowing Bashar al-Assad's regime. And so those are the two different differentiations between the two. Both of them have a very extremist form of ideology, Islamic ideology, that they follow. But they have that strategic difference. And then there are a whole host of other Islamist formations that essentially gained support as the conflict was militarized, as Syrians were forced to take up arms to defend themselves as a result of the massive amounts of repression by Bashar al-Assad. The question of how do you fund yourself in being able to get those arms arose. And basically the main sources of funding were coming from places like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar. And they, of course, funded organizations that were politically in line with them. And so as various Islamist formations ended up receiving the majority of funding and arms, and therefore, again, gave them a leg up as opposed to the more democratic, nationalist, and secular forces inside of Syria. And so there's different groups that are aligned with different states. Some groups that are funded by Saudi Arabia, most of them tend to be Salafi groups. Some groups that are funded by Turkey and Qatar. And again, each of them kind of represent the geopolitical interests and competition of these various states. And that's kind of the general terrain of the different Islamist formations. The Muslim Brotherhood was actually much weaker in Syria than in, for example, in Egypt. Its leadership had been forced out of the country essentially in the 1980s when Bashar's father killed, imprisoned, or exiled the vast majority of the Muslim Brotherhood leadership, on top of killing about 20,000 people in Hama in a massive massacre when there was a revolt against him then. But that resulted in a situation in which the Muslim Brotherhood was actually very weak organizationally inside of Syria. So they formed largely what was the backbone of the external opposition based, whose base was in Turkey, but had very little influence or control over any of the, certainly not over the movement in the beginning in terms of the mass uprising, but also not over many of the factions that emerged, the armed factions and groupings that emerged as the war was, as the uprising was militarized. It's important to note that, you know, sectarianism on the one hand is certainly utilized and instrumentalized by regional ruling classes as well as by imperial powers. But it also, in a way, often reflects real unevenness in terms of access to economic power and political power among the populations, right? And so there is, in some way, a material basis for that difference, and there are religious, you know, differences and ethnic differences that exist among the population. What allows for sectarianism to kind of emerge and become the dominant driving force is, on the one hand, the fact that the ruling classes regionally, nationally, and internationally instrumentalize it for their own purposes, but on the other hand, also the fact that there's been the region, as a result of a whole set of historical circumstances, has lacked an alternative political ideology that can actually explain the cause of misery, the cause of the massive inequality in the region, in the form of a left. And without that project, without a left project that can kind of cohere resistance on a class basis, that the ability for sectarianism and people to fall back on sectarian ideology, you know, becomes a possibility.
So the two major conditions that laid the groundwork for ISIS were, on the one hand, the sectarianization of the uprising against the United States occupation. And this was the conversion of an Iraqi national insurgency into a civil war between Sunni and Shia forces. And the Shia state, the Shia Iraqi majority, backed by the power of Iran, was able to secure their position in the armed struggles both between 2006 and 2008 and those leading up to the emergence of ISIS in 2013-14. The other condition was the counter-revolution waged by Bashar al-Assad against the Syrian revolution. Not only did he unleash merciless violence against protesters, but he also released some 1,500 experienced jihadists into the movement in order to sectarianize it and present himself as the only stabilizing force, the only secular force, the only non-fundamentalist force in the region. And when ISIS emerged in his country in 2013, al-Assad got exactly the monster he needed in order to justify his own rule. Initially, ISIS experienced major military victories, seizing territory in both Iraq and Syria. However, in the face of the US-led coalition on the one hand, and Russia-led military initiatives on the other hand, ISIS has been considerably pushed back, with major onslaughts against both its Iraqi and Syria holdings, as well as other bases throughout the region. But despite these military advances, ISIS has managed to adapt, falling back on the patterns developed by Al-Qaeda, attacking urban centers in the Middle East as well as in Europe. ISIS has also begun to claim the attacks of lone wolf terrorists, adding to its credibility and to its ideological reach. What makes ISIS possible isn't simply a set of disasters in the region, but also an underlying condition of social and economic inequality that continues to divide the people along class lines.
So certainly in terms of territorial, you know, expansion, ISIS has lost a lot of territory as a result of essentially what is an international consensus at this point among the various powers, although they're competing for influence over Syria and what Syria will look like in the future. There is agreement by Russia, the United States, that they want to, you know, that they want to push back ISIS and defeat it. And so there has been a massive campaign of bombing by the U.S. To push back ISIS, as well as support for various local armed forces. So in Iraq, that's taken the form of essentially supporting the Iraqi army, and then also Shia militias, which have really led the attack on ISIS in the various cities and strongholds that they have in Iraq. On the other hand, in Syria, on the ground, that's looked like that has been both in terms of a de facto arrangement with the Assad and the Russians. That is, they share the airspace both to be able to attack ISIS, while Assad and the Russians also attack the democratic forces. And then on the ground, they've tried to essentially create the what they've called the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is largely made up of Kurdish forces to fight ISIS with some Arab representation as well. And they have been able to push back ISIS. They've lost significant amounts of territory at this point. Their main stronghold left is in Raqqa in Syria. The issue with this is, though, is it really gets to none of the root issues that allow for the growth of ISIS or Al-Qaeda or any other Islamic fundamentalist groupings like them. And so we have an example in the first American attempt to deal with Al-Qaeda in Iraq before it morphed into ISIS, in which they essentially carried out a massive campaign of arrests and attacks against Al-Qaeda in Iraq, combined with what they called the surge, right? Of U.S. forces that the Bush administration led. So on the one hand, they increased massively the amount of repressive power. And on the other hand, they organized what was called the Anbar Awakening, right, which was an attempt to gain Sunni support for dislodging Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And they were successful for some time with this. That was on the basis of a massive amount of repression, increasing troop levels, you know, bloodying Fallujah. I mean, completely devastating that city. And on the one hand, they spent billions of dollars, essentially, to gain the support of Sunni tribal sheikhs and sections of the Sunni population in the Anbar province to break, you know, to essentially turn them against Al-Qaeda. All of that, of course, was on the basis that the Sunni population would be included and gain more power in terms of the Iraqi government, right? It was that combined with the billions of dollars that they were able to spend to essentially cohere the Anbar Awakening. That collapsed, though, because the American forces were never able to deal with the underlying problems, which was essentially a Shia government in Iraq that continued its sectarian policies. And so, therefore, as soon as the money dried up, that was being spent to cohere the Sunni Awakening, the councils. And as soon as it became clear to the vast majority of Sunnis in Anbar that, in fact, there was going to continue to be a government in power that was sectarian, and that would repress them. For instance, there was a massive repression in 2012 in Iraq of what was mass protest against the sectarian practices of the Maliki government, and so. Being that the U.S. is unable to resolve those underlying problems, groups like al-Qaeda will always regain currency, and they'll transform and morph into a new form and regain that. And those problems are, rule by dictatorships who use sectarianism, whether it's the Shia government, in Iraq right now, or Bashar al-Assad's government who represses who repressed the major uprising, or the years of imperial domination, devastation, and humiliation of the region, as well as the neoliberal policies, which have created massive amounts of inequality, where you have some of the most absurd accumulation of wealth in the region, paired with some of the greatest poverty in the world. So those three factors, dictatorships, the imperial devastation of the region, and finally the massive amount of inequality because of the neoliberal policies, are what open up the space for groups like al-Qaeda and ISIS to be able to recruit and maintain support in the region. And until those factors are taken up, they will continue, like I said, to reemerge in different forms, right? So al-Qaeda in Iraq was pushed back in the mid-2000s, only to reemerge as ISIS, even larger and stronger, as the underlying conditions were not done. They've pushed back ISIS today to their remaining strongholds, but then they carry out terrorist attacks on a world basis, and they kind of diffuse again into smaller terrorist cells, right? And I think we'll continue to see different versions of this until those root issues are addressed. And more, and the vehicle for that, of course, is not U.S. imperial intervention or quote-unquote humanitarian intervention, which I just said only further exasperates this and is incapable of dealing with the underlying issues, because it relies on dictatorships to be able to carry out its interests, because it is, because the U.S. is essentially the leader of the neoliberal world economic order. So they're not going to deal with any of these underlying issues. So it requires a different kind of movement that we saw emerging in 2012 in the form of mass protest, democratic movements that are the real alternative both to U.S. imperialism, to the dictatorships, as well as the reactionary Islamist extremists like ISIS and al-Qaeda.
This concludes part one of the episode. To continue listening, you can find part two on our iTunes or Google Play podcast feed, or at our website at synergy-studios.org/propaganda.